Hello and welcome to another BullerSense.com political podcast with me, Matt Buller, and San Diego's political professor, Rick Epps. This time, we're on board the Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior 2. The original Rainbow Warrior was blown up by the French equivalent to the CIA. So Greenpeace built another one, and this time around, they did this very interesting avant-garde design. The ship has a traditional engine and an electric engine and sails. However, the sails don't fly from a traditional mast that goes down through the center of the hull. They are hooked up to these masts that kind of come outside and form a triangle that goes up and around the entire hull, freeing up the hull space for all kinds of stuff. And they're hoping that this, when they're using this design, this kind of avant-garde design, it'll work as a proof of concept for cargo ship builders. So cargo ship builders will be able to see, look, we can put sails on our cargo ships and save hundreds of thousands of dollars in diesel fuel costs. It's insane the amount of fuel that those cargo ships go through. Save them a lot of fuel costs, not require them to carry as much cargo. It's definitely worth a look, and I'm surprised shipbuilders haven't at least examined them as viable options, and I wonder what the arguments are against them. I'd be very curious to see what an opposition argument to this kind of sail design would be, or something similar to this would be. I'd be very interested in hearing that. Nonetheless, this ship is very cool. They have a heliport. They put a helicopter on board. They've got a full, you know, galley, conference room, satellite uplink. It's very similar to the ship they were using in Russia, and we talked about the Greenpeace adventures in Russia right now. We sat down with Captain Joel Stewart and a Greenpeace Oceans campaigner, Cassin. It was a fascinating hour. You know, of course, like I said, we talked about the Russian military seizing a Greenpeace ship and arresting the 30 activists on board. The captain knew a lot of those guys. He's very passionate, very personal story about that. And we talked about sort of one ironic aspect to global warming and Arctic oil drilling. We also talked about San Diego's and their relationship, our relationship to Bumblebee Tuna, and read parts of a letter from the San Diego CEO of Bumblebee Tuna to Greenpeace when they invited him on board. Greenpeace is having issues with the method by which they fish, and he talks about it in there, and they want to encourage other forms of fishing. But it was very interesting to hear the letter from the CEO of Greenpeace. The CEO of Bumblebee. I'm sure he did not expect Greenpeace to read the letter on air. So, and of course, I know you've got an opinion and you're dying to share it. So you can jump on your soapbox by jumping on ours. Just call 619-663-4531. 619-663-4531 and leave a message. Ask a question. Make your point. And maybe we'll put it in the next BullerSense.com political podcast. And now for the BullerSense.com political podcast with special guests from Greenpeace. Enjoy.
Let's just kind of tell us about yourselves and how you first got involved with Greenpeace and with this. Uh-oh. Destroying the equipment already.
Hey, it's
our ship.
Belongs to us.
Exactly,
yeah, right?
Exactly. Possession's 9/10 of the law. Yeah.
So okay. Go ahead.
My name is Joel Stewart. I'm captain on the Rainbow Warrior. I got started with Greenpeace in 1989. I wanted to work for an environmental group that had sailing ships and that was doing a positive change for the environment, and it seemed like the perfect fit for me.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
So were you a sailor before? You kind of are using that skill
right,
in this arena?
Right, I've worked most of my life on boats and ships.
Oh, okay.
Now, have you been on multiple vessels other than Rainbow Warrior 2?
Oh, yeah.
Were you on Rainbow Warrior 1?
No, I wasn't. I started in 89. I was blown up in 85.
Yeah.
The captain that's in prison right now, or that was just released on bail, He was on the first Rainbow Warrior when it was blown up by the French Secret Service in New Zealand in 1985.
Yeah. A lot of people aren't aware, or for some reason don't remember that.
Yeah, a lot of people forget that, or they mix the story up. But it's a classic example of how governments or large corporations try to silence Greenpeace. It's, the way to silence your opposition isn't by killing them or bombing them or
throwing
them
in prison
for non-existent crimes. But that's kind of what our Arctic 30 people are facing right now.
Have you had that kind of the similar thing in Russia happen in other countries?
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
Give me a more recent analogy, because they don't get a lot of attention. I mean, the Russia one got a lot of attention, and when we came through sort of on our tour earlier, and we were talking to some of the media people in here, it got a lot of attention because they were able to live tweet and live stream some video while it was happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that made a huge difference as far as getting this, you know, at least Greenpeace's story out, whereas incidents that happened before kind of require so much more that, you know, traditional style reporting that, you know, a lot of the just as it happens information just doesn't come out.
That's
because
true.
It's the corporations that own the media outlets, and so they're invested in keeping a certain image of Greenpeace.
That's right, and having alternative sources of information is really important, and Greenpeace has been quite successful at using social media to get out the message. And up in the Arctic, the attempted banner hanging that the Arctic Sunrise crew and activists did was a good example of going to a very remote area where they didn't have access to shoreside news outlets. And so it all had to be sent out by satellite. There wasn't any other way to get that information out. But we were able to get some really good footage up, which was very good in our defense, because when my friends were accused of being pirates or hooligans, it's very clear from the videos we sent out, they had their hands in the air in passive postures where they were not being violent, they were not posing any threat, and that was quite evident. So
whereas other times, I think that's not as evident, and Greenpeace can be painted in a very different light.
Yeah, but Greenpeace is always sticking to our non-violent, peaceful principles, and we are very clear about that. We always stick to those principles. Anybody that gets onto a Greenpeace ship or is working in the Greenpeace office or is doing any type of a protest or even a photo op has to go through our nonviolence training. So we really stick to those principles, and that's why one of the reasons why we're successful, and that's one of the reasons why the governments and corporations know that we're not a threat, except for what the words and the images we use to expose the crimes that they're doing. That's
but now you can more easily do that and more quickly and without worrying about any filter. You don't have to go through someone like me or some other journalist to get your image out there. You don't have to.
That's right. Well, and we've had more than 2.5 million people signing the petition to get our Arctic 30 people out of prison and also to get a global sanctuary in the Arctic.
So they were, just so everybody can get that story, because I know that personally I've had a lot of challenges getting just even that story kind of on mainstream news, and it's definitely something that's coming more from either national sources or the web directly from Greenpeace. Just kind of tell everyone what Greenpeace was doing when the Russian military boarded the ship.
Well, it goes back some years that Greenpeace has been trying to get a global sanctuary in the Arctic, and Greenpeace was successful in getting a global park, World Park Antarctica. And that was a 50-year moratorium on resource extraction. So we do have a good history of asking for big things and getting them. And the Arctic is such a fragile area, and the only reason why the oil companies are allowed in there now is because the ice is melting and they actually have access to areas that they didn't before.
So global warming is part of the larger business plan? I'm kidding. Right? Well, we were joking about that out there earlier. How it's kind of ironic how all of this global warming has melted the ice caps and made it more accessible to cause global warming.
It's this horrible cycle, this downward spin that the oil companies insist on subjecting us to. But there's a lot of people, and I feel optimistic that there's a lot of people around the world that do want a clean energy future. And this is why we've gone back to the Arctic. We've been there several different years. The Arctic Sunrise was there last year at the very same platform, hung a banner on it, and they had no opposition, no arrest, and everything was very peaceful.
So that's what you're hanging a banner.
That was it. That was the two people went there. They had a small yellow banner on the side of a 550,000-ton oil platform, that they weren't going to block it, they weren't hurting anybody, they weren't stopping the operation, they were just putting a banner up there. You could maybe argue that they are guilty of misdemeanor trespassing, but they did not commit any crime as far as like piracy or hooliganism or anything like that. So they attempted to put a banner up. They were stopped because of extremely high-powered water hoses and the Coast Guard coming up and firing shots.
The Russian Coast Guard firing.
In the water near our boats and in the air nearby there. So they immediately arrested those two people, and then the next day the commandos, SWAT teams rappelled, abseiled out of the helicopters onto the deck of the Arctic Sunrise and at gunpoint seized the entire ship and crew and then towed the ship to Murmansk. They were more than 112 or 120 hours, something like this, before they were even notified of what the crimes would be. Mm-hmm. And my entire crew, my colleagues, the crew on the Arctic Sunrise, were very shocked that they heard that they were being charged with piracy. And at first they were just laughing. They said, this can't be serious. And then they were suddenly found out how serious it actually was when they, most of them were in there over 2 months, and two of them are still in prison right now. And that's 67 days they've been in prison in very grim conditions. And fortunately, 29 have been granted bail, but my good friend Colin Russell has been given 3 more months of pre-trial detention, which would keep him in prison for a total of 5 months up until February 24th, I think it is. And that's just completely unjust. It's unfair. Colin's a very decent human being. He's very peaceful. I've sailed with him many, many years on Greenpeace vessels. He doesn't have a violent bone in his body. He's just a caring person that wants to protect the Arctic, and he's concerned about the climate change affecting his children, his daughter, and her generations to come. So this is an act of conscience, and they're political prisoners. They should not be in jail.
Let me ask you a question here. So a couple of things. One is, what has been the United States government's response in order to help facilitate the release of the prisoners?
I don't think the United States has done too much. Not that I've heard of. They've made consular visits to the two U.S. Citizens that have been in prison. The captain was a U.S. citizen and one of the campaigners. So they have done the consular visit, but they haven't been pushing too much. Now, Greenpeace has their international offices in the Netherlands, and our vessels are flagged in the Netherlands. So as Dutch-flagged vessels, the Dutch government stepped in and asked for an arbitration at the United Nations International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. Right. And this ruling just came out on the 22nd Friday. And the ruling, a binding ruling, was that Russia should immediately release the Arctic Sunrise and all of the crew and the two journalists that were on board of the vessel, all 30 people and the vessel. Now, Russia has stated that they're not going to abide by that ruling. So it's creating quite a diplomatic stir. We've had a lot of heads of state, including Germany, Italy, Russia, Argentina, Brazil, Iran, the UK, a lot of heads of state, a lot of prominent politicians, hundreds of MPs, 12, 13 Nobel laureates, a lot of celebrities, a lot of people are coming out in support, and as I mentioned, over 2.5 million people have signed the petition. So it's creating a groundswell of movement of people that want justice for our people to be out of prison, but on a larger scale, we want justice, we want climate justice. We want to have a world that's free of fossil fuel tyranny, where these oil companies or coal and these extreme frontiers of getting oil, whether it's in the Arctic, whether it's the tar sands, or whether it's any deep water drilling in the Gulf or in New Zealand, or mountaintop removal, coal exports, all of these fossil fuel extreme frontiers are going to be a carbon time bomb which will destroy the planet. We know very clearly from scientific evidence we have to leave carbon and fossil fuels in the ground. We cannot put it in the atmosphere. So there's a lot of people that are supporting us on this.
How much power do you think the UN has in these kinds of situations? You know, they're having they just had the conference in Warsaw, the UN Environmental, I forget what it was called. It was the big
conference of parties.
No, they just had
that was the one in Warsaw.
COP 19.
And that one is even, you know, within the UN, they're having, that one, people are saying that one was co-opted.
But this is an example of what I'm saying about how the fossil fuel tyranny, they've hijacked that, the climate talks. And so the coal industry had a side-by-side conference going on right now. So they had corporate logos of the fossil fuel companies in the climate talks.
It was COP19 brought to you by Shell.
Yeah, exactly.
We cannot trust the fossil fuel companies to dictate our future. And that's what people around the world are coming up, not just Greenpeace, but a lot of other organizations are calling for climate justice and a freedom from this tyranny. We just can't let it keep going.
Yeah, one of the problems in this, I know one of the big arguments has been there have been scientists have been co-opted as well who stand on the opposite side of this. You know, we have this sort of misguided notion that everybody who's a scientist has ethical and moral base, and many of them don't. And it's unfortunate because it also clouds the reality of your argument, which is legitimate, because these people on the other side who have their own vested interests and their own vested economic interests are selling a completely different political notion. Even the United States Senate, you know, our Congress is notorious for a number of village idiots, and I do call them the village idiots affectionately, that will try to justify the lack of climate change, or that it's this misguided, you know, science fiction stuff, and that it's not real.
Well, I mean, locally we've got John Coleman,
the
weatherman here at KUSI, which is a television station, and he's a complete climate change denier.
Yeah, well, there's
one of the guys that helped found the Weather Channel.
There's a couple of
he gets a lot of
attention. To make here. First of all, is if any. There's like 99.9% of the actual climate scientists that their expertise and their field of study is climate that have peer-reviewed publications. Yeah. They're all in an overwhelming consensus agreement, 99.9% or higher, that I'd say irrefutable evidence of anthropogenic climate change. So I think that we have to stop arguing about if climate change is real or do you believe in climate change like it's an Easter bunny or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is irrefutable evidence. Now you have people like the Koch brothers that are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in disinformation.
Yeah, on, that 1%.
And there's a lot of scientists that have received large amounts of money to come up with climate denier pieces, and a lot of the media as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to look at what the facts of the real scientists that are studying it are, and that's very clear, I think.
What do you think happens? Has the ability to tweet and get instant information, get out there vis-a-vis the communication networks that are now available, has that made it safer for you to do your job? Because now you can sort of instantaneously, if somebody like tries to board you or tries to do something and tries to create a negative image about an event that takes place, that now you can actually show instant information to sort of dispel any sort of myths, lies, and rumors?
Yeah, that's a tremendous tool that we like to have on our side. We've traditionally used cameras as our safety net, and so we take photos and images, but now we're able to get that out, but also we're able to have eyewitness views with tweets or any of the other social media. And we're a transparent organization. We don't have anything to hide, and I think that the more we can get out what we're doing and what other companies are doing is good. This is a core principle of Greenpeace, is bearing witness. And
I think a lot of it, though, is like Russia doesn't care. Right?
Well,
they don't seem to care. They didn't care when they threw the Pussy Riot in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, basically, you know, all they did was say something obnoxious. And then they've been in prison now. And they're
two and a half years in prison for
saying something obnoxious in a church.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I was saying anti-Putinism.
Anti-Putin, okay. About someone specific in power.
Yeah.
But Russia doesn't seem to care as a larger political entity if people know this, and they seem to, in a lot of ways, they kind of draw strength and are emboldened by this and see this as a way of proving their power.
Right. Well, we know that Gazprom, the operators of the rig, called the Coast Guard in, and they're implicated in requesting a heavy action. If Gazprom were to say, we don't want the Arctic 30 people should be released, I think that we know that they would be released very soon.
Yeah.
But what's really important when you talk about if they care or not, Shell is implicated, because Shell has partnered with Gazprom, and Gazprom needs Shell to develop the oil in the Arctic, and Shell is very susceptible to public opinion because they're a publicly held company. Gazprom is a state-owned company, so they don't care so much. but Shell does. And they're implicated in my friends being in prison for 2 months, and they're also implicated in reckless behavior of going into the Arctic in a pristine environment without adequate safeguards, and in spite of the scientific evidence that they cannot burn the fossil fuels that are in the ground there. So they're implicated very much, and I think we have to divest our funding away from Shell because they're not a responsible player in the Arctic.
So what do people at home do? I'm a soccer mom.
Okay, if you have it, funds in a bank that's investing in Shell, then change your bank account.
Yeah.
If your pension is investing in fossil fuel companies, well, think about the future. Think about the future of your children and divest. I think the divestment is a very important thing. And you have to also understand that the stock value of these companies is based on their assets that are in the ground. Mm-hmm. So they're betting that the legislation, which they've paid campaign funds to mm-hmm. make sure that they get the legislation they want, but their stock value is based on the fossil fuels in the ground. And they're betting they're going to be able to take it out of the ground and have it burned and put into the atmosphere. So once people realize that the scientific evidence says, no, we can't do that, or we're going to have catastrophic climate chaos, then that stock value loses its money. So on purely economic sense, people should divest from fossil fuels.
So why does the media sort of portray this image? And I think it's an unfair image, by the way. Let me just say that, because I've been a Greenpeace supporter for years and years. But let me just suggest to you, they try to create the image like, oh, these are a bunch of crazy people out there just, you know, creating havoc. And, you know, I mean, the image, how do you deal with the image, problem that is, which is unfortunate and I would say borderline criminal, that how they try to portray your organization? How do you dispel that in a way so that young people can have a greater understanding of what it is you're trying to do?
Well, first of all, we're not crazy because we're getting our information from scientists. So unless you want to call the best scientific minds on the planet that we have, if you want to call them crazy about climate change, well then...
Well, why would you let the facts get in the way of a good story?
Yes, right.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, you know, as far as for danger, you know, what we don't do dangerous things. Greenpeace has a very strict, rigorous training process, and we have a good risk analysis, and so we make our operations as safe as possible, not just for our own crew, but also for the crews of other vessels. So we do a lot of training, we have a lot of safety talks, and we have the best safety gear available for our people, and we make sure we don't endanger the lives or the property of other people. Also.
So you were in, one of the reasons we were told you're in San Diego is because of bumblebee and tuna fishing. So.
You can jump in now with the
Barry White voice.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
Who are you? Who are you?
Who's this guy that's been sitting at this table and not saying anything? My name's Cassim Trenner.
Uh-huh.
I am an oceans campaigner for Greenpeace US. I'm the lead campaigner for our sustainable seafood work here in the United States. And it's great that we're finally able to come down here to San Diego with our flagship, because just as you said, it's a real legacy here in San Diego in terms of how the city has related to the ocean, the old fishing industry that was very strong here for a very long time and has unfortunately dwindled away and is largely a thing of the past now, aside from sport and charter and that kind of stuff. There are two companies that remain here that are still very involved in ocean resource exploitation, and those are Bumblebee and Chicken of the Sea. Both of these companies are of extreme concern to Greenpeace right now. I'd be happy to get more into it about the specifics, but that's the main reason that we've come to San Diego, is because of those two companies. Yeah.
So give me an example of what they're doing.
So the tuna industry in the United States is, or the canned tuna industry mm-hmm. in the United States, is focused really on two different species, skipjack tuna and albacore tuna. Skipjack tuna is sold as light tuna, and albacore tuna is sold as white tuna. Skipjack's the majority of the market, but albacore is still a pretty big chunk of it. Both of these companies sell both of these species. The species exist differently in the ocean, and so we need to fish for them differently. They're both relatively abundant. When we talk about seafood sustainability, we talk about, you know, population strength. Mm-hmm. It's important to not confuse the concept of sustainability with the concept of abundance. You can have a lot of something and it's still not sustainable, because you have to look at the management and whether or not it's impacting other things.
Like the 50,000 pounds of chocolate you were given.
It's extremely abundant.
At some point, you will run out of this chocolate.
It is extremely abundant, but it is not sustainable.
Yeah, because we do not
have an effective management system.
You're just giving it to anyone that will eat chocolate.
It's a completely open resource, yes.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. It's actually a very good analogy. There's a lot of reasons to be concerned about overfishing and fishing issues and seafood sustainability. And one of them is, well, are we running out of the fish we're talking about? In the case of these two, that's not our primary concern. What our primary concern is the way that the fishing implements that are used, the way that the gear and the methodology that's used is impacting the ocean in a larger way. So, for example, the skipjack lives on the top of the water and is fished with large nets in purse seine vessels. They go, they see the skipjack school, they set a net around it, they take the whole thing. Albacore isn't fished like that, but we'll stick with skipjack for just to start. Modern skipjack seiners use something called a fish aggregating device. A fish aggregating device is basically a big floating raft. You can use anything. You can use this table. This table would be a great fish aggregating device, or FAD. We call them FADs. All you have to do is take something like this and stick a radio beacon on it and throw it in the ocean. And just let it sit there. It's called soaking. You let it soak there for several weeks. Now, the open ocean is pretty much the most similar ecosystem that we have on the planet to a desert. There's not much there. It's just pretty much empty. Most of the life in the ocean exists in the tidal areas, exists off the coasts, down in coral reefs and stuff like that. But in the open ocean, there's really nothing there. I've gone on transits on Greenpeace vessels where we're just rolling down across the equator, and sometimes we just stop and jump off the boat wearing, you know, snorkel or a tank. There's nothing. Like, it's just empty. So if you're a fish and you're living in the open ocean, and that's what you're used to, and all of a sudden you have some visual stimulation, it's interesting. It's like the most interesting thing you've seen in a long time.
It's like when you stick your finger on the tank at the aquarium and all the fish kind of go to your finger.
You're full of good analogies, my friend.
I'm all about dumbing it down.
You really are.
Yeah, I really am.
You really are.
I need to make things simple.
Yeah. That is actually one of the biggest challenges with this campaign, with the tuna work, is that it's very hard to make it simple. It's extremely important, but the things that we're asking for and what we're trying to do are so kind of wonky. It's tough. So I appreciate
you have a nerd alert. It's hard.
Oh yeah,
it's hard politically to get people to understand why a lot of things are important because they're nerdy.
And one of the great advantages of being in San Diego is this is one of the most literate populations in the country when it comes to tuna fishing. Like, there's a real history here.
Well, yeah, jobs here. It matters on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, so we can talk about it more directly and more openly and more effectively than we could in some other places.
So what you're worried about then with the skipjack tuna?
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So the fat is out there in the ocean. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's providing shade. It's providing stimulation for visual stimulation, all these things. So you get these little tiny animals that come under, see the fat and come under the fat for shade, for protection from the sun. Then slightly bigger ones that see it, and then they come, they can eat the little animals. Yeah. Bigger ones that eat those, bigger ones that eat those. You know how this works, right? Until eventually you have an entire ecosystem under this fish aggregator.
Under this invented...
Yeah, everything from the little tiny plankton to big sharks that are circling. Mm-hmm. Because that's where stuff's going on. It's like you're crossing the desert and all of a sudden you see a bar. You know, you're going to go in.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only bar around.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's what's happening. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a radio beacon on this thing, right? So it sits out there for 3, 4, 5 weeks and all of a sudden the ship's like, all right, let's check this out. So it hits a button, sends out a pulse to the radio beacon, which beeps it back. So it's, okay, there it is. It's 50 miles that way. So they go, they find the fad, they set a net around it, and they take the entire ecosystem, everything that's under it. This is a very efficient fishing method, right? You don't have to go look for the fish. They come to you.
Yeah, right?
The problem is you take a lot more than just tuna. You get the skipjack that you're after, but you also get sharks, you get rays, you get juvenile tuna of other species.
Because you've created an ecosystem.
Created an ecosystem. And ecosystems in nature are not
monospecies. It's like a fake reef in a lot of ways. Like we have those out here. We have the parks and right off the coast here.
Exactly. So you end up attracting a lot more than what you want to catch. And the other problem here is that a purse seine is a pretty devastating way to fish in terms of the what we call the mortality, the chance that anything that's caught in it is going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
When you put that net around the fish and you haul them up, you're talking about tons and tons of fish in this net, and this net is constricting tighter and tighter. The weight of the fish themselves shreds the animals inside it. We were boarding purse seiners in 2000, I think it was 2011 or 2009,
mm-hmm.
off the coast of Ecuador. I was in one of our ribs. We were coming up on a purse seiner that was in the process of hauling.
These are like the giant nets that kind of look like a big teardrop in a way.
Those are trawl nets.
Trawl nets. Okay.
These nets look like big purses.
Big purses.
You set them in a circle, and then you have a little skiff that acts as the drawstring.
And you just seal and cinch up the whole thing.
And honestly, a purse seine net in and of itself is not a very bad fishing method. Like, you can use them very effectively and in a very benign manner.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have all sorts of stuff in there, it's a real problem because everything in there is going to die. When you haul that net out of the water, it's just raining blood.
Yeah.
It's really pretty grisly. So anything that's in there, your sharks or whatever, that maybe you have an endangered silky shark in there or something like that, because these things get caught in these, you can't let it go.
Yeah.
Or it's dead by the time it hits the deck. So we have a real problem with just the carnage that's mm-hmm. associated with this. It's not the skipjack. It's everything else.
And that's what they do locally.
That is what the vessels that are selling tuna to Bumblebee and Chicken of the Sea and Starkist,
mm-hmm.
that is how they catch the skipjack that goes into Chicken of the Sea light tuna mm-hmm. and Bumblebee light tuna.
And so those are private, and they sell the tuna to the business. It's more of a cannery in a way. That's how it works.
It's a little bit more complex than that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the supply chain that works that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then there's all sorts of little, like Bumblebee and Chicken of the Sea, they're owned by larger companies that also own boats, but those boats don't necessarily supply these particular companies. So sometimes they have to buy from other companies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a big mess.
Yeah, yeah.
Both of these companies, by the way, used to be American companies, and neither one is American any longer. As a matter of fact, all three of the big tuna brands used to be American companies. They're kind of like some of the most American logos you can think of, you know, like Charlie the Tuna for Starkist forever.
Yeah.
Charlie the Tuna is now a Korean company. Chicken of the Sea is now Thai. Bumblebee is now British.
See, that's the catch, though. Most people in America have no clue that a good portion of the food they consume, the products they consume, are not controlled by American companies anymore.
That's right.
They are just names are there, but they're part of a foreign subsidiary.
Well, a lot of San Diegans don't realize how international what they see is there, because they see Bumblebee as a local company.
Absolutely.
It's seen as a, you know, I grew up with guys friends whose dads worked on those fishing boats. No, I worked for Bumblebee. That's how they did it, or they worked in that cannery.
Yep.
But they don't even realize.
Here's the question for you, though. Why do Bumblebee and, let's say, Chicken of the Sea, why do they not change their fishing habits?
Okay, so it would be an expensive transition in terms of the infrastructure that they use, but I don't honestly think that's why they don't do it. I think it's two other reasons, both of which are more important than the expense. Number one is ego. These companies have been operating with impunity in the high seas for a very long time, and they don't like being told what to do. I think it's just part of the human condition. You've got these guys that just don't want to give in to the Greenpeaces of the world. They know better than anyone what is going on out there. They've got all sorts of suggestions and ideas and ways to waste time dithering around and pretending to solve the problem, but really they just want to continue to dominate the market. The other reason is they do not trust each other. Each one of them thinks that if they agree to go one way, they're going to get undercut by all their competitors.
Who are going,
won't go that way. And also will start to undermine them and chip away at them, because they all depend on each other, right? Tuna is an odd industry. You look at it and you see these three companies that seem pretty much the same. You're like, well, okay, well, you know, three direct competitors should be able to use one to change the marketplace, but they really don't work that way. It's less of an open competitive marketplace and more of a cartel. There's a lot of cooperative price setting. There's a lot of mutual support. This idea that, like, well, you know, they'll buy from each other, they'll sell to each other, they buy from the same traders. They all do well as long as they all do well in a lot of ways.
It's like gasoline companies.
It's a lot
same
like
way.
That.
Same thing. They all set the price points and they keep it where they want it.
What's the difference between tuna and oil?
Yeah.
It's a resource. People are extracting it out of unmanaged areas. They're doing what they can to undermine the government, the governmental bodies that are trying or allegedly trying to regulate it. And whoever has the biggest drill, or in this case the biggest net, gets there first, gets the resource.
Or the biggest gun. Yeah. They get to be the international law.
Yeah. But at the same time, you'll see commercials from some of these companies where they're trying to show themselves to be, kind or gentle or friendly or, we're here to help. Shell has some companies.
PR is magical, isn't it?
So people go, they're trying to help the environment. It's all a load of crap. Or they made those meager... superficial things at it, but nothing like what they really could. That's why I teach political science at the university for many years, and I talk about this issue. And one of the things that I always tell my students that, you have to be careful about the images that are created for you. That this is one of the dangers, is people constantly look and they see that 5 minutes of, they synthesize information so much more quickly and in a very superficial manner now than they used to when we were growing up. So,
I hate it when you say stuff like that. Yeah, whenever I say stuff like that, I always feel really old when I say that, because it's like, I remember paper. I remember paper, it's like, my kid's not going to use paper.
Okay, he
probably
won't
use paper.
but
it's true. But at the same time, you wouldn't have been able to get that video of the Russians boarding the ship and live tweeted out the instant it was happening.
Exactly. But the problem in this, is
it's the reverse side of that coin.
There's a good side to it, but the negative side of that is that they're so used to getting instantaneous information, and if you have instantaneous information, it doesn't always have to be accurate information, because it's not about the accuracy, it's about how quickly I can sell that image to you, and you're going to walk away from it.
Rachel Lang had an interesting thing sort of about this. She ran one of the mayoral campaigns for a guy who just barely lost, but she was talking about how it's not about whether or not it's true.
Yeah.
It's just about repeating it enough times.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And these companies have enough money to where they can repeat, if you've got a big enough megaphone, you can repeat anything you want enough times.
Yeah.
And at some point it becomes true. It just becomes a truth.
Yeah.
These companies are shrewd debaters. And a shrewd debater in a situation like this will identify the strength of its opponent's argument. Ours is extremely strong. Ours is founded on science. That's why we're doing this. They know that if they engage in a debate with us about this, they will lose.
Yeah.
So they fabricate their own scientific whatever to cloud the issue.
Yeah.
But they don't debate us on science. We come to them with science, and they attack our credibility.
So
that's what a shrewd debater does.
In a way, you have to become more of a grassroots campaign then, and deal with the people that are
that's true
buying their stuff and supporting their candidates. And
also, that's very true. But also, when they attack our credibility in terms of trying to dismiss our argument, why would these guys know anything about science when X, Y, and Z?
But you're just a bunch of hippies
attacking people in Russia.
Right.
Completely nonsense.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we have to do is we have to come to the table with more than just kind of a spotlight on what they're doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We need to come to the table with a solution, because we're only going to have a few seconds to be able to make these connections. And if we have a solution that we can deliver, it's very, very difficult for them to just dismiss us. So what we've been able to do is really splinter the demand in the marketplace by creating solutions. And in conventional areas, if you go to Walmart, of all places, Greenpeace has worked it took about a year.
Okay.
There is now we call it fad-free. It's skipjack caught without the use of a fad, which is what we're campaigning for. There's now canned, fad-free skipjack tuna in Walmart. 4,000 locations across the country at an affordable price.
Wow.
If Walmart can do it, these companies that are resisting it, not only do they lose their credibility, they lose their market share. And that's the kind of language that we need to speak to them.
Well, you also have to do, when showing those solutions, you have to also be able to shine a light on that solution
a
very international. That's the only way you get any action, is by having a spotlight on what the solution is. If the solution is there, but the spotlight isn't there, then it gets sort of lost in the quagmire.
Right.
So you've got to be able to put the solution out in a way that people who can actually impact policy.
What's the solution then to the argument when people say, "Oh, you're coming here to shine a light on Bumblebee, but that's going to cost San Diego jobs, and we need jobs"?
Bumblebee is going to cost San Diego jobs.
But
Bumblebee already has cost San Diego jobs. Bumblebee is part of this larger tuna influence that has destroyed and is destroying the resource. San Diego the tuna industry, the idea that Greenpeace is coming here to somehow harm the tuna industry is ludicrous. There is no tuna industry in San Diego. There used to be. Now you have Bumblebee. Now you have Chicken of the Sea. Yeah. And that's not San Diego. Yeah. That's Thailand and the UK. Yeah. That money's not staying here.
Yeah.
We want to talk about building jobs in San Diego. We need to talk about protecting the tuna resource. Mm-hmm. And that means challenging those two companies. And that's why we're here.
Mm-hmm. But you know, that's funny. I just thought about an analogy of it's like corporate farming. This is corporate. Yeah. This is
illusion that there are family farmers out there. Yeah.
And there's only a handful of family farmers who are all corporatized. Mm-hmm. Just like prisons are all corporate now. You know, I mean, they want to put money where they can.
Prisons are big business, man. That's the one down here at the border. They only do immigrants, and they get $190 a night per person in there.
They can
hold them for a maximum of 60 days, and so everyone stays 59 days. It's pretty amazing.
I think they say it's the fourth largest industry in California.
Prisons? Yeah. Prisons.
And it's growing. Mm-hmm. It's a problem. It's growing. It's not diminishing. It's growing.
Crime pays.
Yeah.
Crime pays really, really big when you're at a certain level. When you're like a cop on the street, doesn't pay.
Mm-hmm.
Cops on the street start at $35,000 a year in San Diego.
The crime that really pays, though, is environmental crime. If you can get away with that kind of resource extraction and that kind of just complete lack of accountability out in areas of global commons, you're going to get real rich.
Well, that's the other thing, too, right? You're not dealing with American law. You're not dealing with local, state, federal laws. You're in the middle of the ocean, you know, dealing with international law.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, you get... But, you know, a lot of people think... Oh well, international law, the UN, the courts, you know, that'll make. But you know, the truth is like, you know, the if you're right in international law, if you have a bigger gun, right? Whoever's got the most power in whatever situation, they're the ones that can do what they want
the
in
ICC
those places.
The ICJ are just defunct. I mean, the International Criminal Court is a, you know, no, it's a problem. There's no the sovereignty rights of every individual nation impede the ability for the international courts to do their job.
Yeah.
So even if you try to light on it or try to bring criminal charges against those who've been, you know, abusing it, you know, your countries themselves won't let it, you know.
But there's an opportunity there, too.
Yeah.
If governments are savvy enough and accountable enough to their people to realize that they need to use their claims on sovereignty to be able to defend their people's own economic well-being, the government then is logically forced to get more engaged in the creation of accountability in international law. Because if we're talking about the management and exploitation of multinational resources, then a government needs to stand up for its protection. Otherwise, other forces will take it and rob that government's people of their right to those resources, their right to their future, and their right to a relationship with the ocean.
But they can be hypocrites and kind of solve that problem too, right?
Sure.
I mean, you're expecting them to be logical and not hypocritical, and human beings are really good at being hypocrites.
That's certainly
true. Let me ask you a question. So in terms of, because one of the things, like, you know, California's a tourist, we couldn't even get our act together. They have GMO put on our side of our food, so you know what, your food is genetically modified, which is embarrassing. Mm-hmm. That people,
that was embarrassing.
They tried to lie to tell people it was going to cost $400 a year each person.
By the way,
just put a stamp on the side of the food.
You know who donated quite a significant amount of money to the anti-labeling campaign? Bumblebee.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you about. That's what I wanted to ask you was are there attempts to genetically modify this by putting food sources into the tuna population?
The reason that...
So tuna will be 10 times the size?
So
kind of like Hogzilla?
Yeah,
even,
exactly. Yeah.
There absolutely is that kind of thing happening when it comes to aquaculture, fish farming.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the case of this particular legislation, it wouldn't have really mattered because the feed that would be used in a farm to grow a fish, even if it's GMO, mm-hmm. would not have counted as GMO food in terms of what would need to be labeled for mm-hmm. public consumption. For if I'm growing a salmon mm-hmm. and I'm giving it GMO soy to grow, but I didn't actually genetically alter the salmon, it wouldn't have needed labeling.
So
even in that case, it wouldn't have mattered. But for Bumblebee, and this is all, you know, my opinion, but Bumblebee gave a lot of money to the anti-GMO labeling campaign. I believe Greenpeace's perspective is because Bumblebee has been promoting a new line of food. They call them Sensations, which is what we call an enhanced seafood item. It's tuna mixed with other stuff, vegetables, mayonnaise, different flavors. Now, I don't have to put GMO on my tuna because my tuna is not GMO. Yeah. But if I mix it with genetically altered bell peppers, then I would.
Yeah.
And that's not going to look good.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's regardless of the reasoning, this is the kind of companies that we are dealing with.
Yeah.
Companies who will spend thousands and thousands of dollars to make sure that consumers do not know the truth about what they are eating.
Yeah. Which leads me to my next question. Has to do with education, you know, because one of the things that I was sitting here thinking of this in the midst of our discussion here, that in the, you know, K through 12 arena, long before they get to think that college, they think they're too smart for everybody, right? that you know, like internship programs, you know, different types of educational programs for young kids to start learning early on about organizations like Greenpeace and organizations like Greenpeace. So that by the time they get older, they start, you know, you'd be surprised how questioning mommy and daddy about, why are we eating this stuff, actually has a profound effect on most parents about how they respond to what their kids are consuming.
Yeah, you really don't have your first existential crisis until you have a kid.
Exactly.
And then you just, it's insane, the weird things you never thought you were going to think about that you start to think about. So it's a great opportunity to hit people.
Yeah, to hit them. And if you start with them young, and I just wonder, does Greenpeace have an educational structure? Because that would be a great way to grow the organization in a very grassroots from the bottom up would be to get something in place for young kids, even through teenage years, where they could maybe intern or, you know, be able to help create, you know, where they can make a direct connection.
It would
be tremendous.
There are some opportunities for like that within the organization. I think we could do a better job in terms of creating spaces that were a little bit more regimented and a little bit more definitively available. This is an area where I think we could do better. That said, there have been some really great examples of Greenpeace collaborating with children to make a big difference. I'll just give you one. In 2009, Greenpeace was campaigning to change Trader Joe's, the way that Trader Joe's was selling seafood. There was a lot of issues with their labeling and them selling unsustainable products and stuff like that. During the campaign, we received a letter from a elementary school in Los Angeles. That a private school that said, you know, we put a lot of focus in terms of our children's curriculum on causes and on charity, and we vote as to which charity we want to support at any given time. We do one a year, I think it was, and this year we've decided to work. That your work has really spoken to us as Greenpeace, especially the seafood work. How can we help? So we ended up having all these kids, you know, from ages like 6 to probably 12. Drawing pictures for Trader Joe's, like pictures of this is what the ocean should look like and why are you killing these animals, like expressing to them the feelings of these children over what Trader Joe's was doing. And Greenpeace and those children, we won that campaign. Trader Joe's changed. And this was a very, very isolationist and really reticent company. These guys, like xenophobic almost, really not wanting to do this, really not wanting to engage. But you get children on board, they're so authentic.
Yeah.
They're so authentic and they're so honest and they're so hard to ignore because they're so right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, but that is a great way to start. You know, but I really do think, and as an educator for you know, a long, long time, that just one of the things I would say, I think, you know, that is a great, you know, a cornerstone for opening up avenues. Like, for example, let me share a couple of ideas that just as an educator here. So one, Camp Greenpeace, where in summertime kids could have a week to go or maybe whatever, go and work on an issue, you know, in some place that helps them be able to be, you know, identified with that. Also, when they get in high school, when you get even to college, where colleges have where they do a semester on boats and stuff, do 3 months on a Greenpeace boat for as an internship program for your, that you get college credit for. You know, things that help bring new blood to your organization, but also makes the nation more cognizant when you have a nation that's so driven by, you know, things that are unhealthy for it. And let's face it, the United States is one of the most unhealthy nations on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at, you know, people laugh at third world countries. I would argue at least they eat food that isn't genetically modified most of the time.
Really horrible people laugh at third world countries.
I know. But I mean, but yeah, but people look down on, you know, because they're poor, but they don't realize when you have food that's modified, it's just, you know, it's just slowly killing you in a different way.
Yeah.
When you have chicken breasts that look like turkey breasts now, yeah, that's not a normal. You know, our parents saw, oh, look how big this breast is. Like, Mom, you know what? I hate to break it to you. Yeah. It looks like a turkey breast and it's a chicken. Yeah, okay, yeah. There's something wrong with that, you know? Yeah. Kind of like the turducken. What the hell is a turducken, right? Yeah. Yeah. How'd they get there?
Yeah. Look how all these tomatoes are exactly the same size and color.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
They have no taste anymore.
No.
You ever notice
no.
when you have organic stuff versus non-organic stuff? The flavor tastes of the bug is not there.
It's a huge taste difference.
Oh, yeah. Terrible. I used to wonder what my mother used to say all the time. Food doesn't taste as good as it used to have that way. She's just getting old.
That's why we have to get back to locally sourced organic food and keeping GMO out of it is that key part.
Yeah.
We can't fix climate change if we don't fix the industrial agriculture also.
Yeah,
we
right.
have to get back to a localized, organic, clean, sustainable, non-chemical intensive agriculture.
You've got to get people to buy into it too. We would not be afraid of somebody telling you it's going to cost you $4 a year.
And we're going to create jobs also.
Thank you.
It's important too to look at the energetic and the intentional reality that underpins our food system, right? Our food system really is the physical manifestation of the relationship between the human being and planet Earth. That is how we exchange nutrients. That is how we exchange energy through eating and drinking, what we eat, what we cultivate, how we do it. If we can't get that right, how are we going to get something as abstract of a relationship as climate change right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is our real chance to really, because fixing our food system is good for us. It's a selfish win, you know?
Yeah.
So that's where I believe we have to start. We have to make choices about what we eat every day in a way that nourishes us. Because if it nourishes us, really nourishes us, not fills us up, not tastes good, nourishes us, it will also necessarily nourish the planet.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you guys are going from here down through Central America, the Panama Canal?
We'll go down through Mexico, Panama Canal, Colombia.
Are you going to make stops
Mexico.
Along
yeah, we'll
Baja?
Be doing
are you doing
a
similar kind of tour kind
We're
of thing?
We're doing a lot, yeah. Sustainable agriculture and non-GMO will be a big part of our Mexican tour along with climate change.
Where are you going to stop down through Mexico?
We've got several stops. We're still working on it. I don't have it right off the
you
top.
You don't have the top yet? Okay. All right. I'm just curious. Are you going to do any? You're not. But it's more of the same. Give more awareness, showing people the boat.
Yeah.
You're not doing any actions. And
well, we don't announce actions.
Oh, I'd love to know if you're planning something against
Pemex.
We're
trying to campaign in the most effective way possible. And sometimes that's not actions. It's engaging the public in different things. And so we're going to be having a lot of town hall type meetings and.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we do with Greenpeace is attract people from the communities onto the ship, like decision makers from industry and government and NGOs, and we talk to them about finding solutions.
Was that easy to do in San Diego? Were you able to get people from San Diego's political scene?
We're still
scene
working
and
on that. Not so much from the political scene, but we're meeting with a lot of different people to find some solutions.
You weren't able to get Todd Gloria to come down? He's the interim mayor, because we had Bob Filner.
I don't think
Bob Filner's no longer on but Todd Gloria didn't come down.
That would be
because this is his district. You're docked in his district right now. That's interesting.
Well, we should invite him.
You should.
I'd like to have him here to talk to.
You should.
It's an important thing that's the important side of this also is the fact of we sort of had this sort of misperception that the people who represent in politics are these all-wise people who understand these concepts. Now, some of them purposely will undermine the causes of Greenpeace and organizations like this. There are other ones who are just ignorant of it, just completely ignorant of the reality of these issues that, on very localized levels, that it would be important for them to be able to...
Yeah, but
they might appear ignorant, but you have to look at where they get their campaign financing. If they're getting their money from fossil fuel companies or from Monsanto...
Or their local tuna businesses.
Right. Yeah. Then they have vested interests in protecting the interests of the corporation.
And inheriting the messaging that they're getting from their interests. This is an email I just got from the CEO of Bumblebee. Give you some excerpts from it. All right? We invited the CEO. His name is Chris Leshefsky.
Mm-hmm.
I've met him many times. He's an extremely intelligent man. We invited him to come down for a tour, as we have invited him to talk many, many times. And he says, great to hear you are enjoying our town. We understand there's some work to be done on your $30 million plus luxury yacht. I don't think we will make it downtown.
You've got a helicopter.
Yeah.
I think when Carlos Slim was knocked here, he had a helicopter too.
Yeah, exactly.
I think.
So these are the kind of things that companies that have a vested interest
that's really obnoxious.
Listen to this. We would be very happy to engage in productive discussions with you on tuna, but your actions don't demonstrate a real desire to work collaboratively or sincerely. your positions are based on emotion and not science. I would be very frustrated working with a group that tells you and the young people working with you what their positions need to be when there is no scientific basis for their positions. But hey, you guys do great dance videos on your yachts. So this is the kind of
credibility.
Oh yeah. So yeah, they attack our credibility. They do not debate the science with us.
Yeah.
They just tell us or tell everybody that we are incredible. And then they, of course, go to their elected representatives and tell them this.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to be able to get Daryl Issa to come down here.
Yeah, of course not.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah. If he did, he'd see it's not a luxury yacht. It's very much a working vessel.
Or, exactly. Or Duncan Hunter is not going to come down here.
Well, we've been around it today, so we know it's a working vessel. It's a newer vessel because it's only a couple of years old.
Yeah, it's very clean.
But it is a functioning, it's a very working vessel.
Yeah, this does not. Yeah,
it's not a canoe. It's, you know, yeah, they don't have oars off the side. They have to, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry to break it to you.
But I mean, that's the thing that I was wondering about too. Is how were local, you know, people in the local political scene responding? You know, did you get city council people down here? Did you get any of our other, you know, maybe the other congressional members, Susan Davis, come down? Did any of the more sort of traditional left wing people in San Diego make
I think
an appearance?
This is probably
about, like, Surfrider Foundation is another.
This is probably an area where I personally probably dropped the ball a little bit. I don't think that the campaign did as an effective of a job of creating outreach and invitations for folks like that as we could have. And
so when I see Todd Gloria, because I'm going to see him Tuesday, for he'll be on the morning show. I won't have to.
No,
I don't have to yell at him for not showing up.
No, but tell him we'd love
to
talk.
He would have come down.
Yeah, you're going to be here a couple more weeks.
When do you leave? When do you guys leave? When's the boat?
Well, we're finishing our campaign side of things on the 26th, and then we're going to be shifting into a maintenance mode, doing a few modifications and some warranty claim issues we need to take care of.
Okay. So then,
so if he's still here, if you got some people who are still around, it'd be great for him while if there's someone needs to come in and be able to have a conversation.
Because I wonder how, because you talk about tuna industry and the sea, it matters to business here.
Oh, yeah.
It matters hugely. Yeah. And it's a major, and that, and we're in the middle of a mayoral election.
But you have to be able to make sure that the illusion of saying that you're costing us jobs is dispelled. That's
and
what you have to
and maritime industry is a major local mayoral issue because the maritime industry is all based out of Barrio Logan, which is near National City, which is where a lot of the dry docks are.
Mm-hmm.
Barrio Logan does in that area. They have a lot of industrial space there, but it's also predominantly a Hispanic neighborhood. Used to be heavy crime, but it's not so much heavy crime anymore. Yeah. The guy who's one of the guys who's running for mayor is from Barrio Logan. He's sort of the Democratic candidate, even though technically our elections are nonpartisan. But he's sort of the Democratic candidate running against Kevin Faulkner, who's sort of the Republican candidate. But Kevin Faulkner's a very beachy kind of Republican, so he does the Surfrider thing and kind of that.
Yeah.
And his district is Pacific Beach, La Jolla.
Yeah.
So his district is coastal.
Yeah.
But it's tourist, but it's definitely very coastal.
Yeah.
So you've got two very different kind of coastal experiences there. They're trying to throw all the maritime businesses out of Barrio Logan and make it residential only because, you know, they say it's polluting the neighborhoods and the people that live there. Barrio Logan's been a huge, that invention of that neighborhood when they built the five, I'm sure you remember that.
Yeah.
It's been a huge, no offense, but it's been a huge controversy for a long time when they created.
There used to be canneries down there. That's where a lot of the canneries were down there.
And that used to be just Logan Heights, that whole area. But then they built the five freeway. Cut this community in two, and then so a bunch of local activists took over the park there. It's Chicano Park now. They just kind of occupied it. It was way pre-occupy anything, but they took it over and turned that space underneath the bridge into a public park and became a public park. And that was 74, 75?
74, 75.
Something like that? Yeah. I can't remember. Yeah. But and they lived there.
I was a very young child.
They lived there for like 6 or 7 months making that park?
Yeah, almost a year.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But so that traditionally that area has been all maritime industry.
Yeah.
And they're looking to, they want that out because they want people to live there now that downtown, residential downtown, they built the ballpark, they want to build a new football stadium downtown. The high-end real estate, the residential downtown is extending into that neighborhood now. So to increase the property value of Barrio Logan.
Mm.
So it's this real...
Kick the people east.
Gentrification.
Yeah,
gentrification. Yeah. So the canneries, the maritime industries, just in general are being pushed out. It's a huge local political football that's been getting punted back and forth, even in this past primary. You know, and you know it's going to be a major issue when they go to go to the main election.
Having a working waterfront is very important for the character of a town, and if it's which you have to make sure you have good environmental regulations in place, so it's not polluting, so you do keep clean water. And
well, you want to be watch your discharges. And in this case, people are going to live next to that. It's more than they're living two doors down from a lot of these places.
Like Seattle, San Diego, San Francisco.
Those are working waterfronts.
Working waterfronts, great ones. And even Los Angeles, that port down at San Pedro, the working waterfront. You know, Long Beach, working waterfront. And they managed to be able to.
Well, that was that's the issue, right? And then how do they? They're going to expand the convention center over the waterfront. They wanted to shift all the docks, where they the cargo shipping. They wanted that. People had this weird idea that didn't last long.
Yeah, but you know what? Look at San Francisco. When you're there for those, it's not an ugly sight to see the docks there. It's actually well kept, very clean. I mean, it's not like they have to be this disgusting looking. You know, not the old days, like back.
But there's a real opportunity there for Greenpeace to get involved in specifically in local politics.
I mean, a working waterfront is a relationship between a city and ocean.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And like with any relationship, if one party is all take and the other one's all give, it's not going to work.
Exactly.
And that's what's been happening in so many cities, including San Diego, for so long. If there really is going to be a vibrant, healthy waterfront, then you need a vibrant, healthy ocean. And that means that
that's
San Diego and the other people here that depend on it, we all need to start giving back by protecting the resources that will sustain that waterfront.
Well said.
And having some marine protected areas would be very good for tourism.
Fish would be good too.
I have a very dear friend who was a captain here for fishing for 35 years, and he's been retired for probably almost 20 now. But he would say how the fishing here at the end was just nothing out there. It's like it's just been overfished and over. They have this notion of not being able to sustain it. It's almost like when you overfarm a land and then you have to use special fertilizers that make it do what it was, but it's not naturally supposed to do. It's
or let it go fallow.
Exactly.
Plant cover crops. That's what marine protected areas has been found, that it really increases the fishing. So what it gives this safe place and habitat for fish to grow and spawn and nursery grounds, and then the fish will migrate out of that area into areas that are allowed to fish. So it actually increases the fisheries to have marine protected areas.
Yeah, because the fish don't recognize the border of the... Right. Well, thanks for stopping by. I know it's only been an hour. I know, and I like the tour of the ship. I'm very impressed.
No, this is really insightful.
I love the...
Take a picture of me and Rick here.
I want to talk to you about this stuff, too. I actually have some ideas. Seriously, I'm not kidding. I'm really...